Thank you for attending session 135, titled Mormon Women Write, Life, Writing, and the Construction of Mormon Womanhood. Before we begin, we ask that cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respective dialogue. Please keep in mind when engaging in the Q&A portion of the session following the remarks of the presenters. Those who cannot abide those guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked should they become asked to leave should they become disruptive. The session is being recorded and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Take advantage of our symposium special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine, 7 issues for the price of 6 at the registration desk as well. Consider also purchasing Skull Candy official headphones customized just for Sunstone. There you go. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore and the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. And as a courtesy to the other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after the session you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin preparation for the next session. Drawing on their Puritan heritage, early Mormon converts were avid life writers, keeping diaries and journals, writing autobiographies and life sketches, and even producing word cookbooks. Life writing continues to occupy a significant place in Mormon culture, especially among women. This presentation examines Mormon women's life writing across time and culture, showing how Mormon women's understanding of themselves as individuals and as part of God's kingdom continues to evolve. And our presenter today is Emily Ward, who is completing an MA in English at Idaho State University. She defended her thesis, which is titled Spiritual Autobiography and the Construction of Female Identity, a Comparison of Puritan and Mormon Life Writing, in April 2016. So now we welcome Emily Ward, who we will hear.
Hello. Full disclosure, I am terribly, terribly nervous. This isn't just my first Sunstone Symposium. Well, it is my first Sunstone Symposium and therefore my first presentation here. So it's a big day for me. A little bit of background about me. I come from Idaho, and I've lived in a lot of different places. This presentation will be a little bit of a combination of both academic and personal work, talking about some of the things that I've discovered as I've delved into Mormon women's journals and life writing. Dawn and Joanne Linneberry write in the Encyclopedia of Mormonism that journal writing has become an integral part of the religious experience of many Latter-day Saints. And such a claim is more than just academic for me, for I am one of the millions of Mormons worldwide who's kept a personal journal since my baptism at age 8, off and on with varying degrees of success, as I'm sure we can all relate to. I grew up firmly in what I call, and what many of us might know as, the Mormon Belt. The Mormon Belt extends from Rexburg, Idaho, and some points north, all the way south to Gilbert, Arizona, with little pockets in Canada, particularly in Alberta, and in California. And by and large, this is where Mormon culture thrives and defines the cultures that surround it. Both of my parents were born in Salt Lake City, Utah, and so I was enculturated with that, despite the fact that we moved around quite a bit as we were in the active duty in the military. When we finally settled, we wound up in Las Vegas, which for many non-Mormons doesn't seem like a particularly Mormon place to grow up. But many of us will know that that Las Vegas was actually settled by Latter-day Saints, that it has a strong and thriving Latter-day Saint population, and a temple was built there while I was young in 1989. And so it still is heavily influenced by a Mormon culture and is a strong stronghold of that kind of thinking. Having grown up in this culture, I was profoundly affected by its norms and expectations. When I turned 8, I, like many thousands of kids in the Mormon Belt, was gifted with what I playfully term the Mormon Starter Kit. That includes your first set of scriptures. Often it has a little carrying case that goes with it. You often receive your first journal and one of those plastic banks from Deseret Book that has the big section in the middle that's for your tithing, and a section on the side that's for fun, and a section over here for your mission, giving a pretty strong impression of what your expectations are, that tithing is first and foremost, that you will be serving a mission, and that you're allowed to have a little bit of fun now and then. Let's see, my first journal has room right in the front for vital information. It asks me to list my parents and my grandparents, where I was born and when. It asks for some genealogical information, for some things about my siblings and about things that mattered to me when I was 8, which are a lot of fun to look back on now, and then leaves a lot of room in the back for personal journal entries. I won't tell you what I wrote in that journal, partially because some of it is real embarrassing, and none of you are my posterity, so tough noogies. But I can tell you that what I wrote were things that I was instructed to write in church. My very first journal entry was the night of my baptism, and I wrote in it my testimony of the current prophet, Ezrith Staff Bedson. Clearly, I was not good at spelling, and it was a hard name to learn how to hear. But that very simple testimony was the beginning of lots of different testimonies that appear throughout that journal and throughout journals that continued afterwards. It also includes lots of things about things I was studying in school, some important events in my life, like when my parents divorced, when we moved, when I changed schools, all of those things and all of those impressions. And firm in my mind always as I kept that journal was that this was a record that was being kept for a specific purpose. And that purpose was that at some point I was going to have posterity who were going to care very much about what a 9-year-old thought about the third grade. Part of the reason I believed that was that Mormon leaders admonished members to keep a record of important life events. Lessons in Sunday school teach how and what to write in our personal histories, and new software on the church's family history site encourages members to upload their personal histories and autobiographies. Spencer W. Kimball, the president of the church when I was very young, compares vernacular life writing within the LDS culture to scripture. He likens them to the written expression experience of scriptural writers. He specifically terms such work as, quote, the literature of superiority, and assures readers that, quote, the angels may quote from even informal journal-style spiritual autobiographies. That's a lot of pressure for not just an 8-year-old, but for all of us, as are all members of the LDS community and faith, as we try to keep a record of our lives. When I was just beginning my undergraduate work, I took a survey course on early American literature. And given that the rise of the novel didn't come until the early 18th century, many of the readings were nonfiction. That included reports and journal writings from Columbus, travelogues from John Smith, some very bigoted but entertaining writing from an ancestor of mine, William Byrd, in Virginia, and most importantly, a narrative of the captivity and restoration of Mrs. Mary Rowlandson. As I read this Puritan woman's life writing, she felt very familiar to me. The ways that she expressed herself and the ways that she read her life as a scriptural text from which she could learn was very familiar. Mary Rowlandson was captured as a prisoner of war, basically, and redeemed during the King Philip Wars between the Puritans and the Indians in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. After her capture, she was kept by the Indians for a few months and recorded several different removes. And as she does so, she talks about being snuck a Bible and how that Bible helped her to cope with her captivity. She talks about having certain scriptures come to her mind and bring her comfort. She talks about the providence of God. As she crosses rivers, she has a severely injured foot, and she prayed before she was forced to cross the river that her foot wouldn't get wet and become infected and that she wouldn't get sick, and it didn't, and she attributes that to the providence of God. Here was someone who interpreted her life primarily through the lens, through a haze of anxiety about living an ideal life. She wonders all the time if she's going to heaven. How can she tell? Why are these awful things happening to her? Has God abandoned her? All of these things and more felt like my own journal and the journals of many other Mormon life writers I had read over the course of my life. Years before, I had read the life sketch of my own great-great-grandfather and was fascinated by his story. The power of his conviction led him to sell everything he owned and cross the Atlantic with his wife and children. Family stories, the origin of who we are as a people, is bound up in this life story, as is the story of Robert Bodily's conversion. Other stories of Robert's son James solidify our family culture of sacrifice and piety. One of the more familiar stories that gets passed along in the family quite a bit is that Robert Bodily was fairly affluent. He had emigrated from England to South Africa to colonize there, where he met missionaries and decided to emigrate to the U.S., to Zion. It costs a lot of money to get on a ship and take your whole family across the Atlantic, and many people couldn't afford it. So Robert sold up everything and paid for not just his, but several other families' passage to Utah. He frequently lent money and oxen to the church to help other saints immigrate after he got to the Salt Lake Valley. And the story is that he saw Brigham Young on the street one day here in Salt Lake, Brigham told him that if he would come by the office, that he would be reimbursed for the monies that he had given to help saints cross the plains. And Robert told him that he didn't need to worry about it, that he didn't need the money back, and that everything was given to the Lord and he was fine. The story goes that Brigham clapped Robert on the shoulder and told him that he would be blessed for his generous nature, and that his family would never suffer financially because of his sacrifice. That story gets passed along a lot because our family suffers a lot from financial struggles, as we all do. But it brings a level of, or a certain amount of hope and fortitude, I guess, that if we just wait around long enough, Robert's promises will be fulfilled in our family, and maybe it's not as bad as we think because we're not starving yet, right? These kinds of stories, as they're passed along in life writing, define who we are, not just as families and my own family, but who we are as a larger people, about what we think about sacrifice and about forming our cultural identity. The problem with Robert's story is that while it's uplifting, it doesn't say very much about Robert's wife, Jane. The story credits her with the family's conversion, but she is silent. She never wrote a life sketch or kept a journal that still remains. Similarly, James's wife, Mary, never left a record of her own life. Beyond my own family's history, the history of the Mormon movement is largely dominated by the life writings of men. I wondered if women speak for themselves at all. I found a book titled Women's Voices, An Untold History of the Latter-day Saints from 1830 to 1900, and read it eagerly, glad to finally hear from women. Out of these experiences came a desire to further study the relationship between Mormon and Puritan life writing, which was the subject of my thesis. As I considered where to go next with my research, I was particularly impressed by an article by my thesis advisor and mentor, Dr. Susan Swetnam, who is a non-Mormon, who did a really important work for both Latter-day Saint history and Idaho history at Idaho State. She collected the life writings of, she asked for the life writings of anybody who had LDS stories and collected over 100 of them at the Idaho State University Library, and then did a full book study of the conventions of those stories and their significance in the history of the state. As she looked at these documents, she was struck by the formulaic nature of Mormon biography, except when it came to when women were writing biographies about women. She notes that many of these biographies seem contradictory. Mormon women write their ancestor mothers as both paragons of right Mormon living and dedicated faithfulness and transgressive performances of Mormon womanhood. Swetnam concludes that these biographies suggest that Mormon women in the 20th century have, in some ways, taken the lead in the church's biographical tradition, and as they do so, they make editorial decisions to include transgressive performances of Mormon womanhood in order to reframe what Mormon womanhood looks like, to add balance to the official narrative that turns our foremothers into angels of paragons and virtue, a standard that is almost impossible to emulate and is a prescriptive version of womanhood that is no longer satisfying for many Mormon women. Among these transgressive acts are a woman who refuses to cook over a fire. That is not her job. That is not what she signed up for. And her husband was seen kneeling over the fire in the dirt cooking biscuits over rocks. She was not having it. another woman was called with her husband to go settle in Rexburg. She told him repeatedly that they needed to get a move on, and he was not interested in moving at her pace. When they finally wound up only as far as Malad and it began to snow, she went on strike and refused to move any further. They wintered in Malad and only went to Rexburg when she decided that the weather was now appropriate and they were going to go the rest of their journey. These are women who refuse to perform their domestic tasks, who defy their priesthood authority in spectacular and amusing ways, and who have their own identities independent of what maybe the official narrative wants us to believe. The official narrative has us really nailing it, always getting it right. And these women nailed it in their own way, but not in the ways that were expected of them. In a culture that has generally not included women's voices in the official historical narrative until relatively recently, life writing is the largest body of work through which Mormon women speak. Examining Mormon women's life writing can tell us many things, including how Mormon women perceive themselves in terms of their place in the church, what it means to be a Mormon woman, and what the proper performance of Mormon womanhood looks like. Today, I'm going to work through groups of three, basically, to explain what life writing is, what cultural works inform Mormon women's life writing, and what Mormon women life writers say about themselves over three periods of Mormon history to explore how Mormon women's understanding of themselves as individuals and as part of God's kingdom evolves and in some ways stays the same. Before delving into my primary works, I would like to define what I mean by life writing and talk about the kinds of life writing I'll be looking at today. A more familiar term than life writing might be autobiography. The term autobiography was first used by William Taylor, who, writing a book review in 1797 of Disraeli's Some Observations on Diaries, Self-Biography, and Self-Characters. Another writer, Taylor, didn't like Disraeli's term of self-biography as a matter of style and suggested autobiography instead. Ironically, Taylor didn't actually like that term either. He thought it too pedantic, but its next printed use was employed in the same sense, so whether Taylor liked it or not, that's what it means. The genesis of autobiographical criticism or study, like Mormon culture, finds its roots in early 18th century. This period saw the rise of a middle class in England and the United States and the beginning of the Romantic literary movement. The criticism and genre both are products of middle class romantic thinking, both of which had a lasting impact on the study and production of the genre. More contemporary critics began considering other self-referential works, such as diaries, journals, memoir, life sketches, and many other subgenres. These works are referred to as life writing, which can be defined as a broadly based term for any self-referential writing in use, and we've been using that term since the 1970s. Life writing can be any writing that is about oneself, and that includes diaries, life sketches, some kinds of poetry, essays, recipes, and even blogs. Some of the life writing that my family is using right now are my grandfather's. They're not journals, but he was his war chorister for 32 years. I don't know how that stayed, but it's a fact nonetheless. And what he has are notes of every sacrament meeting, every song that he picked, and why, for 32 years. This isn't a diary. It's not a journal. It doesn't tell me a whole lot about specific incidents in his life, but it counts as life writing because it's referencing what he felt about those particular songs and why he chose them over time. So it has the term life writing is a great big tent that allows for all different kinds of writing about yourself, however that looks and however that works. As the critical discussion of life writing expands, so too does the influence of Mormon women's life writing expand in the official narrative. Beginning with Daughters in My Kingdom, the 2012 Relief Society narrative, a correlated representation of the historical events that surround the founding of the Relief Society, it uses the life writings of Mormon women to, quote, teach about the responsibilities and opportunities Latter-day Saint women are given. The recent publication of the first 50 years of the Relief Society, key documents, and Latter-day Saint women's history further shows how Mormon women's life writing, including minutes and notes, is an important part of how the contemporary church defines what Mormon womanhood should look like. The official narrative seeks to align past performances with current expectations. The chapter outline of Daughters in My Kingdom illustrates this pretty well. It's separated out into about eight or nine chapters, each of which has a theme that includes feeding the poor, spreading the gospel, caring for the home and family. Each of these... this shows that Mormon women's writing, history and life writing is important as it is in service to current standards of Mormon womanhood. However, what Mormon womanhood should look like and what it does look like are not always the same thing. Therefore, in order to have a clearer picture of what Mormon womanhood meant in the past and what it means today, we have to look at what the women themselves have to say rather than relying always on the official narrative. In the interest of time, we'll do this by examining the life writing of just a few Mormon women over three periods of church history. The first period is early Mormon history, Restoration through 1900, and I'll be relying primarily on the writings of Emily Dow Partridge Smith Young. Some of those last names should be familiar, and we'll get into why. We'll look at 20th century Mormonism through the writings of Jenny Hill Levitt Smith and Emma Elizabeth Wright. And then we'll look at contemporary Mormonism through the writings of Rebecca Watson on her blog, The Misplaced Americans, and Six Sisters. To gain an understanding of how studying the life writing of Mormon women can give us insight into the ways that Mormon women understand and perform their roles, I'll make some observations on the life writing of each and some general conclusions about each period, followed by general conclusions. As a note, I know the academic convention is to refer to your primary sources by their last name, but once you spend years reading someone's journal, they stop being an academic source to you and they start to be real people. So it's difficult for me not to refer to these women by their first names because they mean something to me. Among the more meaningful events of my summer was my long-suffering husband took me to the Salt Lake City Cemetery here to Emily Dow Partridge Smith Young's grave to take a picture of me with a headstone because she is my girl. Because I know her, because I love her. And so, despite academic convention, you should know that I will be referring to all these women by their first names. Emily Dow Partridge Smith Young is a long-named and important woman. She was born February 28, 1824, in Painesville, Ohio, the third child of Edward and Lydia Partridge. Edward Partridge, as you may know, was the first LDS bishop in this dispensation. After the death of her father, Emily went to work in the home of Joseph and Emma Smith as a nanny and a teacher. It was there that Joseph taught her the principle of plural marriage, which she accepted and entered into with him on May 11, 1843. After Joseph's death, she was sealed to Brigham Young in 1844, crossed the Mississippi into Iowa in February 1846, and emigrated to the Salt Lake Valley in 1848. Emily, therefore, had a front row seat to early Mormon history from her parents' baptism when she was seven until her death in 1899. Of course, even a rudimentary knowledge of Mormon history will suggest that this is not a show one necessarily wants front row seats to, but Emily had one nonetheless. She was a prolific life writer in her later life. What we have of her writings includes a published autobiography in 1884, written for the Women's Exponent and published serially over several months. A personal journal kept from February 1874 until a few weeks before her death in 1899. An unpublished autobiography titled Incidents in the Life of a Mormon Girl, written later. There's not a specific date. And a life sketch titled What I Remember, written in 1884. Emily's writings are interesting because they have three different audiences: herself, her family, and public. She performs her Mormon womanhood in slightly different ways for each audience. In her personal diary, Emily is intellectual, recording her own thoughts on topics that vary from difficulties of keeping the word of wisdom, because Emily loved her tea, the value of work, the proper exercise of faith, the development of the Deseret alphabet, which she was very interested in, even Darwinism, looking at or carefully considering how her faith fit into the Darwinian model, and the place of women in church and society. She can also be a little sassy, which is part of why I love her. One of my favorite passages from her journal reads, "When the Lord pronounced the sentence upon Eve, 'I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception,' she received it as a curse. But when he said, 'And thy husband shall rule over thee,' it was a curse in every deed, doubled and tripled, implying that she or her posterity would be subject to all the afflictions in life that men could invent or devise. For all of that, Emily was a fierce defender of plural marriage, publicly and privately, but she did find men trying sometimes, though she only admits to her frustrations in her private writings. She muses often about the trials of womanhood, the difficulties of being a mother, and where a woman's duty lies. She writes in an entry dated May 27, 1874, that, quote, "Woman's first duty is to her children. Charity begins at home. Let women fulfill their home duties first. Then, if they have any spare time, they can work for the public." She repeats this sentiment often, being firm in her belief that, quote, "To woman is given one of the greatest missions in life, to bring forth and rear mankind. How much depends upon the wisdom and faithfulness of women," end quote. Throughout her private writings, Emily emphasizes her belief that the hardest and most valuable work a woman can do is that of motherhood. She reveres her own mother and comforts herself in her affliction that she was allowed to be a mother. However, what Emily writes of motherhood as a woman's, while she writes of motherhood as a woman's first duty, she hardly believes that it is her only sphere. Though Emily is clear that for her, a woman's first duty is to her family, with particular emphasis given to her role as mother, she also believes that women deserve support, intellectual development, and their rights as citizens. Of the Relief Society, she writes, quote, "The organization of the Relief Societies are for a purpose, not merely to feed and clothe the poor, but to administer to the mind. It is our business to strengthen and cheer and instruct," close quote. In one instance, she writes of a Relief Society meeting that was marred by the entrance of a bishopric. Just before the meeting began, the bishop and his first counselor came in and sat to the side of the meeting. They were about halfway through their business when the bishop stood up and said that he had come to say some words on behalf of the school trustees. The stake president had asked the Relief Society to help the school trustees in building up the school and in teaching and in guiding the curriculum. And Emily reports that the bishop said that the affairs of the school would be glad if the sisters would please not interfere. She reports that he, quote, repeated it the same several times in the course of his remarks and wound up saying he was too much mad and sat down, end quote. Emily is not pleased. She writes, "My heart rebelled as soon as I heard it. I thought it an insult. It seems that some men think that because we are women, they are justified in kicking us right and left. We don't want to interfere with his business. We have enough to do of our own, and we would rather have our labors lightened than to have more laid upon us. Yet we are willing to do all we can in preparing the duties of the ward that belong to us as members of the Relief Society. I came home from that meeting with a severe headache." From the episode, we can surmise that Emily believes that some duties belong to the Relief Society, and that the women in the society can accomplish their purposes without the interference of the priesthood. She might say they have their jobs, and women have their own. Get out of our way and let us go to work. Emily's chafing under heavy-handed men, though, is not limited to an exasperated bishop. She writes in her journal in the midst of two important struggles in the territory regarding women, the problem of polygamy and women's suffrage. Emily was among the first women in the early church to practice polygamy, as she became, as I noted earlier, a plural wife to Joseph Smith in 1843, before the principle was practiced openly. I don't know how much she felt for her second husband, Brigham Young. She rarely speaks of him, except at his death. And then her summation of whether he was a good man or not is in regards to how well he cared for Joseph Smith's family. Emily seems to have given her heart to Joseph when she was young and retains her love for him throughout her life. She records that she received an invitation to a ward party celebrating Joseph's birthday, but while she thinks a great deal of Joseph, I do not feel much like attending parties. If he was going to be there, it would be another thing. She notes in her journal her 50th, 52nd, and 53rd anniversaries of marrying Joseph, and records a touching dream where in her dream, Joseph had come back to live with the saints and Emma was there. And he and Emma were lying in their bed, and Emily's bed was against theirs. There's a thin partition in the wall. So Joseph and Emma are here and Emily is here. And Joseph and Emma are discussing the problems of polygamy and what's going to happen now that the government is coming down so hard on them about it. She says, "I thought very likely that some would not be able to continue to live with Joseph as wives." And she says, "She had been deprived of Joseph's society all my life, Would it be the same now that he had returned? I thought very likely that it would. As he had so many wives, it seemed that some would have to be neglected. Then it seemed we interchanged thoughts, and it was that he had... And he then spoke and said, Emily, I shall keep you with me. When she woke, she took great comfort in this, and expected Joseph to come for her when it was time for her to die. It must have been painful to fall in love with and marry a man at 19 and live as someone else's wife, though often alone, for 55 years. And yet, despite that difficulty, she remained a staunch defender of polygamy. She writes that, quote, the principles of polygamy on plural marriage are as pure as the gods. Polygamy tends to ennoble and glorify. It was not installed for those who love wickedness and would trample on the gems of heaven. It has been given to the earth for the benefit of those who love truth and righteousness. She further argues, I wonder how they, the detractors of polygamy, would like to have us interfere with their family relations and petition government to abolish marriage or compel them to go into polygamy because we choose to have it so. It would be just as consistent for us to do so as for them to interfere with our private affairs. We mind our own business, and we would like others to do the same. Among my greatest blessings, I class the fates that I am a mother and was a spiritual wife, meaning a plural wife. As part of her defense of polygamy and her belief that women are capable, Emily is also a staunch advocate for women's suffrage. She writes, long live women's suffrage and equal rights. No need for four-fifths of the inhabitants of the earth to gravel in the dust in order that the other fifth may stand a little higher. Let them stand on their own feet as a stepping stone to greatness and not on their mothers, sisters, and wives. While Emily's math might be a little bit wrong, I'm pretty sure four-fifths of the world is not women. Her argument stands nonetheless. She further argues, if man wishes to exalt and regenerate the human race, let him take the first step upward by striking off the shackles that bind down mothers and their offspring. Make them free. Let them feel that they are citizens and enjoying equal rights. We wish to be untrampled. Keeping our place of our own accord, we want the right to sing bass if we please, but we may never have the desire to do so. It might seem to modern women that a woman who desires the right to vote but defends polygamy is perhaps a little bit conflicted. But because she lives in a system that subjugates women in many ways, but demands equal rights. But in fact, a major push for women's suffrage in the Utah Territory was to defend polygamy. The leaders believed, and the women believed themselves, that should women have their own vote, they would be able to speak for themselves and defend polygamy in the territory. These two assertions of polygamy and suffrage are not in conflict with each other for Emily. She believed that polygamy was a true and righteous principle. She believed that her life had been blessed because of it. She also believed that she deserved the right to observe her religion under the Constitution, and that as a thinking, independent person, she deserved the rights of citizenship. She deeply resented anyone she perceived was squashing her, be it her bishop, her son, men in general, the women who ran the anti-polygamy missions in Salt Lake City, or the mobs that forced her across the country. She balked at negative perceptions of Mormon womanhood. She writes that anti-polygamists argued that Mormons had too many children, which is an old song, it seems, that children born to polygamous marriages were degenerate, that Mormon women were weak and oppressed, and that the whole system was wickedness. She thus defends her performance of Mormon womanhood, emphasizing her own role as a mother, wife, and independent citizen in privately with wit and sometimes bitter sarcasm, and in public with eloquence and force. Emily's public voice is different from her private journal. All of our quotes so far have come from Emily's private journal writings, but her autobiography published in The Woman's Exponent is a curious mix of personal memory and church history. She begins her story with the story of her father, relying on her memory and historical documents to recount early stories of her family. In this document, Emily's personal story is conflated with the history of the church as a whole. The autobiographical I is absent for most of the record, and doesn't appear at all until far into the story. Instead, Emily uses whole pages of extracts from Joseph Smith history, letters that were written between Joseph and several different people, including her father, William Phelps, and John Bennett, whole sections of the Doctrine and Covenants, and leaves her own thoughts and impressions of the events she tells mostly out of the narrative. She retells, for example, the Mormons' troubles in Missouri in 1833, how they were driven out by mobs, her father was tarred and feathered, and women and children were forced to flee across the river in January, some with no shoes. She writes about the experience in 1832 when she saw the mob take her father away. She writes, "We did not know what they were going to do with him. The family knew that the mob had threatened to kill Partridge, but had no way of checking what was actually going on." Emily at that time was about 8 years old, and records that after the mob had been gone a while, she was on the lookout for her father from a window upstairs when she saw two men coming toward the house. One I knew, the other I thought an Indian. It was our dear father who had been tarred and feathered. Emily is a witness to these events, and it must have been terrifying to see men come steal away her father and have him come back in that condition. But she doesn't record how it affected her as an individual, how it affected her spiritual growth, how she felt about that, or even what her feelings were to see her father hurt in this way. Young's experience and growth is implied in the growth of the church, and her growth grows as the church does. Young and her readers conflate her life experience with the larger movement, so often her own narrative takes a back seat to quoting historical sources. Even as she discusses both of her marriages, both as plural wife, she's not the actor. Active voice would say, "I married Joseph Smith," or "I was sealed," or "I married Brigham Young," but instead, she writes that she was married. She's passive in these actions. Her narrative ends at her marriage to Young, though she lived most of her life after her marriage in 1844, and indeed, her own contribution to the movement came after both of her marriages and her emigration to Salt Lake. Emily's commitment to motherhood and plural marriage are consistent, even if her voice is not. Instead of rejoicing in her own motherhood, Emily's public autobiography valorizes her own mother. She relates that her mother believed more readily than her father and was converted first. Her conversion was a driving force in her life, according to Emily, giving her strength to move her children to Missouri alone, her husband having gone ahead with Joseph Smith. Emily uses her mother to exemplify what the ideal Mormon wife and mother should look like. She was quick to believe, supported her husband in his work, even if it increased her own burden, and cared for her children. This is Emily's ideal of Mormon womanhood. Strong, capable, faithful, and uncomplaining. Her defense of polygamy isn't as rigorous in this document, though it ends with her entry into plural marriage. Emily does make sure to note that Emma was present at her sealing to Joseph, countering claims by the later reorganized church that Joseph never practiced polygamy, and Emma's own claims to that effect, defending the principle as a practice established by the capital P prophet, Joseph Smith. In her private writings, Emily is strident, opinionated, sometimes caustic, and full of personality. In her public voice, Emily is not an agent. She often isn't even present in her own narrative. What can we make, then, of the two differing voices in Emily's private and public life writings? What can we learn about how she performed Mormon womanhood, what she believed was her role in the church? First, the difference in voice according to audience can likely be attributed to rhetorical purposes. As I said earlier, history is complicated in LDS practice. It isn't academic. It's a sacred retelling of God's work among his people in the latter days, and Emily's conflation of her own history with church history in her public writings indicates that the idea of sacred history was present even in the earlier days of the church. Her private writings, however, were her own, and so she poured herself into them. For Emily, the priorities of a Mormon woman were first to her own family. She drew much of her own value in her later life from being a mother, and her daily entries are filled with her life with her children and her value for her role as their mother. Second, she was a wife. She was particularly proud to live the principle and be a plural wife to Joseph Smith. She defended polygamy vehemently and sincerely believed it was a God-given principle that made women better. Lastly, she was an individual with her own thoughts and in many ways a modern woman. One might even say she was a bit of a third-wave feminist before she even knew what that meant, claiming her right to live as she pleased and make her own choices as an independent citizen and allow others to do the same. Good for you, but not for me. That's kind of Emily's motto. Though the church is young, not even 50 years old, when Emily began her personal journal, a cultural foundation had already been established, one that will survive the cessation of polygamy and the spread of the church into other parts of the world. As we move on from Emily, we'll move away from the early history of the church and into the 20th century, with two women who served missions in the Pacific Islands and their writings from their personal journals. The first is Jenny Hill Levitt Smith. Her given name, her actual name, is Jane. She goes by Jenny. She was born on April 18, 1891 in Cardston, Alberta, Canada, and she represents a new generation of Mormon women. She was born just a year after the manifesto that ended the practice of polygamy to a monogamous family and entered a monogamous relationship or marriage of her own in 1911. Jenny didn't identify her role as wife with the doctrine of plural marriage at all. About 4 years of married life in Canada, Jenny and her husband, together with their son, were called on a school teaching mission in Samoa. After they had taught for a year in Samoa, he was called to be the new mission president in Tonga and reopened the mission there. During her time in Tonga, Jenny cared for her infant son, Deloy, taught school, cared for missionaries, studied and learned Tongan, preached in meetings, taught music, organized and led the Relief Society, and they returned to Canada in April of 1920. Jenny's journals from her mission are, in many ways, just like most mission journals you might have read before. Brief, concise, full of lists of days that are the same from one to the other. She's very dutiful in keeping track of everything that happened, and nothing new happens many days at a time. So it's not terribly riveting reading. However, it gives us a really good glimpse of what her day-to-day activities were, what her job as a woman in the mission actually was. Every once in a while, she gives us a glimpse of her individual role on the mission. She writes that in some places in the Tongan mission, she was the first Mormon woman that the native saints had ever met. They'd seen lots of elders, and she was the very first woman. She may have therefore been a model for LDS women for Tongan converts. Her journal indicates that she spent most of her time in domestic tasks, cleaning and caring for children. She taught music and English. She studied to learn the language. She worked hard at that every day. And attending to the auxiliaries, she was in charge of the Relief Society and the primary. Her talent for music was especially in demand. She traded music lessons for Tongan language instruction, taught children LDS music as a missionary tool, performed on the organ to draw crowds in for the elders to teach, and played for dances. It becomes clear that Jenny knew that she had made a strategy for herself based on her own strengths and her own interests and being of use on the mission. She needed to learn the language and use her unique talents and spend every day in study and in music. As she taught music, she taught the hymns of the church, spreading the gospel message the best way that she knew how. Later in the mission, after she was more fluent in the language, Jenny preached in conferences and sacrament meetings and contended with investigators in scriptural points. Her fluency also allowed her to teach other skills, including sewing and general housekeeping. Through her teaching, Jenny, whether intentionally or not, taught the women of Tonga that being a Mormon woman included imitating her customs of domesticity. As she taught them to sew, she taught them to dress like her. As she taught them how to make and sell soap, she taught them how to use it, which was not a practice in Tonga at the time, and how to perform Mormon housewifely industry and thrift. As she taught them to clean, she set a standard for a proper Mormon home. Jenny's white, middle-class culture became bound up with her performance of Mormon womanhood and in her work on her mission. She communicated that to the women of Tonga. Jenny herself sees no difference between preaching the gospel and teaching domestic lessons, writing that she was working to, quote, bring the women out of obscurity and error in her efforts. Jenny's performance of Mormon womanhood, her domesticity, dress, childcare, musicality, and preaching, create a picture of how she perceived herself as a Mormon woman. Though she doesn't overtly explain her priorities as Emily does, we can surmise from her daily activities what mattered to her. Jenny, like Emily, is a mother first, caring for her own son before she does anything else. She is also a woman of intelligence who's confident in her abilities. She studies diligently and makes the most of her skills. Though she's committed to spreading the gospel, she isn't always all that tactful about it. She might be a Latter-day Saint, but this is no saint. One of my favorite episodes in her journals is a particularly memorable entry where Jenny contends with a Catholic woman for 2.5 hours over points of doctrine. She writes, quote, "She kept saying, 'Let's quit.' But I said, 'No, I will prove to you that we are right.' Another woman joined us and two men before we finished. She was certainly glad when I quit. I felt like I could talk all day and prove my points too, as there were so many things that we touched on that she didn't want to take one subject at a time and finish it. But I said we would, and we did. She called me a Fifini Loi. I think that means ant woman, which might indicate that she was biting or annoying or pestilential. I don't really know which, but it doesn't sound like a compliment. At last, I told her it was a waste of time to talk to her, as she was so ignorant. This episode illustrates an important element of Jenny's character and performance of Mormon womanhood. She is certain that she is doing it right. Her journal shows us a woman confident in her abilities and mission. Where Emily conflates her identity with Mormon history, Jenny conflates her gospel living with a particular brand of domesticity and cultural certainty. But Jenny isn't alone in the ways that she conflates gospel living with her culture. Emma Elizabeth Reeve Wright served her mission in New Zealand with her husband Alexander from 1902 to 1904. Emma is a little more strident than Jenny in her insistence on Native people adopting Utah ways. As part of the mission work in New Zealand, Emma assisted the elders in presenting canvas views of Utah's, quote, most prominent places made by the elders. They are doing this in order to show the outside world a little of Utah and the church authorities and a little of the coming forth of the Latter-day work and a vision of what the Maori saints should be striving for in terms of industry, grooming, and domesticity. Emma is not impressed with Maori ways, writing that they are indolent and much in need of instruction on the proper way of things. It isn't enough that the Maori saints accept the gospel. Part of Emma's work is to teach them how to be a Mormon woman in the same ways that the women in Utah are, inviting the saints to imitate dress, customs, and languages as they leave off the false traditions of their fathers. All this isn't to say that Jenny and Emma don't love the people they serve. They do. They're both really upset to go home. But it does show that in just 75 years, women in the Mormon Belt had identified their performance of Mormon womanhood in the context of 20th century domesticity. It becomes clear that the ideal performance of a Mormon woman isn't just about her dedication to principles of the gospel. By the time Emma and Jenny go to the Pacific Islands, it's also about having a certain kind of house that is kept to a standard. There is a standard of dress and deportment. There's a cultural assumption of superiority and authority that is almost impossible to shake. It's remarkable that in so short a time, the culture had formed and solidified so profoundly that the performance of domesticity became bound up in right gospel living. Even more remarkable is that after 100 years, standards of domesticity are still measures of correct performance of Mormon womanhood in contemporary Mormon women's life writing. And my time is running out, and so I'll briefly talk about something that we might all be a little bit more familiar with, and those are Mormon mommy blogs. Blogging became a big sensation in the early 2000s, and the church, in fact, encouraged people, women and men alike, to use their blogs as missionary tools, and even created those buttons that you can create on the side to link directly to the church site or to the I'm a Mormon campaign. Some of the more popular Mormon mommy blogs include all kinds of posts about, with beautiful pictures of beautiful houses and handsome husbands and perfect children and crafts and Relief Society lessons and recipes. And it creates this vision of what modern Mormon womanhood looks like that's almost a throwback to the 50s with much better, or maybe not better, but different style. What's interesting about these blogs is that they're not just popular among Mormon women. There's a whole subculture of single career women who love these Mormon mommy blogs and talk about it in articles in Cosmopolitan and Salon about trying to figure out why they love this performance of Mormon womanhood so much. But what's interesting is that while Jenny and Emma were working so hard to show that the ways to be a Mormon woman are bound up in the ways that you perform your domesticity, that we still kind of hold on to that. Mormon women envy the ones who can make the bread. They envy the people who can do the Pinterest crafts. They want to be the ones who have the wheat and who know how to keep that particular kind of perfect house. And it's a measure against which we measure ourselves, especially in the Mormon Belt. So in conclusion, in terms of Mormon women's life writing, what do we know? What's different from the narrative? What's the same? What's changed and what hasn't? What hasn't changed is that women are to a large degree responsible for the life writing in the church. They write the biographies. Men keep mission journals, but many men don't continue to keep journals afterwards. In modern times, Mormon women have used blogs to perform what Mormon womanhood should look like for them as an explicit missionary tool to present a particular image to the world that others might then want to emulate. What remains the same are the standards by which we judge ourselves and the ways that we conflate gospel living with other things that have nothing to do with the gospel. How you keep your house, what language you speak, what you do in Relief Society that aren't the lesson, aren't gospel living, but we conflate these things together as a way to measure how we're doing it right. As we proceed into the future, it's important to me that we continue to find and to publish these Mormon women's writings so that we can have a clearer view of what the women before us did, how it changed over time, so that we can have a clearer vision of maybe who we were, and to keep what needs keeping and to trim back what we don't really need anymore, and to set ourselves more realistic standards. Thanks.
Thank you, Emily. Thank you for that. Do we have any questions or comments for Emily Ward? Yes. Yeah.
Those sorts of things. Emily Young doesn't go into any of that, but a lot of the other women that I've read have. For example, Caroline Barnes Crosby was one of the first women to serve a mission with her husband, primarily because Brigham Young called him to serve in Tahiti and told her that she needed to create a home in Salt Lake. And she said, I would be such an excellent companion for him. He goes, yep, I'm sure you would. I need you here. And she goes, I know, I'd be such a good companion, so I'm a go. And she went and paved the way for other women to go as well. Jenny in New Zealand talks often about using olive oil as a blessing agent. She doesn't call down on priesthood necessarily, but she uses it to anoint and to give a prayer of faith. She talks often of the women gathering together and offering prayers of faith after women have been anointed in order for healing. And those sorts of stories are more common throughout different journals that I didn't have a chance to talk about today, but it is common. Particularly blessings in preparation for childbirth. Women, especially in more far-flung parts, not necessarily like here closer to Salt Lake, but for example, closer to where I live in Idaho, in Burley, women performed anointings in preparation for childbirth right up until the 1940s when their stake president finally told them to stop. So those practices are recorded in the life writings, and I'm glad you brought them up because it's an important note on why could we used to, and why can't we now, and what does that mean? What's the difference between a priesthood blessing and a prayer of faith? And exploring those writings kind of gives a really nuanced view of that. Yeah. I'm writing all the things. Thanks for asking. Before I went back to school to complete my education, I was a stay-at-home mom for the first 5 or 6 years of my marriage, and I had a blog that I don't attend to at all now, but like to look at because it has pictures of my kids when they were really tiny, and that's fun. I have kept a journal. I would love to continue on my thesis and put that into a book-length work. I have a project coming up where I'm comparing the life writing of as Mormon women write about what polygamy means to them, put that in contrast with those missionaries that were here in Salt Lake for anti-polygamy groups as sort of rescue missions, put those in conversation with each other and see what they say against each other and kind of look at what the rhetoric of marriage actually means in context of Mormon women's life writing. And also some of the primary sources that I have, like for example, Emily, She wrote a lot. And Utah State University has done a fantastic job in compiling a lot of women's life writings. They've done Eliza R. Snow's, they did Caroline Barnes Crosby, they did several others, but Emily's not one of them. And I would love to compile and edit her work so that you guys can see her. She's my spirit animal. She is strong, and she is feisty, and she knows what she believes. And I might not always agree with what she believes, but she stands by it no matter the cost, and I admire that.
There's a step. There is, and it's just going to kill somebody. Okay, so thanks once again to Emily Ward for presenting on women's life writing. Can we give her a final round of applause?
Thank you.